It can be very confusing because we see it everywhere. It can be dangling from people's ears or on a chain around someone's neck. It can be tattooed into someone's arm or, as I saw not too long ago, on someone's chest. Or we could see it as we did on January 6th, being held high and carried across the lawn of the Capitol in the assault on the Capitol. What I'm talking about, of course, is the cross. We have it as a ubiquitous sign all around us. And for us as Christians, it, during this time of Lent, is an important time of exploration for us. And ask the question, what does the cross really mean? What does this cross really mean in your life, in my life, in our lives together as followers of Jesus? To get more at what the cross really means, let's talk about what the cross meant. Originally, of course, most of you know, the cross initially was an instrument of torture. Begun, we think, most likely by the Phoenicians, worked on and improved by the Persians, refined further by the Greeks, and then perfected by the Romans. The cross symbolized a horrible instrument of torture. It was essentially a sign of state-sponsored terrorism, for the Romans especially, in attempting to maintain this huge imperial presence, basically from the southern border of Scotland all the way across the Mediterranean through Egypt into the deserts of Arabia. From the forest of Romania all the way to the coast of Morocco on the Atlantic Ocean, the Roman Empire spanned this massive land area and the Mare Nostrum, our sea, the Romans used to call it. They had a massive and impressive military presence, which of course helped them maintain order, allowing them to expand the frontiers of the empire further. But in order to maintain and control the people within that imperial system, there were methods that the Romans employed that ranged from both benevolent oversight and public works like aqueducts and good roads and adequate transportation and a postal service that aided in what amounted to a global economy that worked extremely well for people like ultimately the Christian church in being able to send correspondence and supporting different churches in different places. But we're getting ahead of ourselves because the cross itself symbolized in those days what the cross really meant was standing for a terrible, horrible instrument of torture that the Romans used consistently to keep people in fear. So it wasn't just doing good works and being benevolent overseers and providing strong laws to help maintain a decent and relatively civil society. There also were punitive measures, and the cross symbolized, in their minds, the Romans at least, the best and most effective way of maintaining order through terror, inspiring fear in the masses. And here's the way it would work. The cross, perfected by the Romans as an instrument of torture, was a way to make a prisoner, usually someone convicted of sedition or traitorous activity, somebody that the Romans had deemed to be worthy of being made a symbol for, somebody that couldn't be trusted, and to send the signal, this is what happens to you if you don't abide by our laws and our ways of being an imperial power. the prisoner was attached to a horizontal huge piece of wood that they would be nailed through the middle of their wrist to. They would be forced to carry this through public streets, ultimately ending up in a highly public area, either by a very well-used thoroughfare along one of the well-maintained Roman roads, or on a high hill where everybody could witness the slow death of this prisoner. Often it was not just one, but usually multiple prisoners that would be displayed in public. What was horrible was that the Romans had perfected this technique of crucifixion that allowed the prisoner to live for a long time, often many days, finally dying by either loss of blood or thirst or hunger or asphyxiation, because hanging on a cross made it so the lungs increasingly could no longer breathe adequately and oxidize the blood. So it was a way of keeping the prisoner alive for as long as possible, for an ultimate and public humiliation that sent this strong message, of course, to the broader society and all the people walking by or witnessing up on that hill the prisoners that were being crucified. This is what happens to people who don't abide by what we believe to be the right thing in our imperial system. It was a horrible way to die, but even more, it was a public display of terror, and it sent the tragic and horrible message to families, because the final piece of the crucifixion drama was that, generally speaking, the prisoners who died on a cross were not taken down. Their bodies were left to rot. Birds and animals would rip at their flesh and ultimately carry away their bones, so that ultimately the families and the friends of these prisoners who died would not be able to bury them. Their bones would be scattered all over the place by wild animals. And as a result, the Romans would be sending a message: if you defy us and you are crucified, you will essentially no longer exist for your families and friends. Your memory will be erased. There will be no body for them to remember, no bones to commemorate, no grave to visit. You will not exist anymore, and your legacy will be gone. This was the final horror of crucifixion. This is what the cross meant. It was a symbol of humiliation, of torture, of terror. Which is why in our scripture for today, in the first chapter of Corinthians, Paul begins this letter. It's the first communication Paul is having with this church in Corinth, and he's addressing a key issue. The issue is both Jews and Gentiles in that congregation, sharing that sacred space together, were struggling with the fact that the cross was supposed to now symbolize God's love for us. And yet the people in that congregation were clearly saying to Paul, which he's addressing back in this letter, this is a scandal for us Jewish people. And the Greeks, the Gentiles, were saying, this is foolishness to us. Why? Because for Jews, it says clearly in Deuteronomy, cursed be the one who hangs on a tree, probably in reference to Phoenician or Persian crucifixion. But it's clearly someone hanging on a tree, that is crucifixion, they are cursed by God. It's in Deuteronomy. It is clear for a Jewish person, anybody who's been crucified is not worthy of being remembered. For Greek people, this is foolishness. For these Gentiles, which the word is interchangeable, Gentiles and Greeks, this is not sensible. It makes absolutely no rational sense to talk about the cross as something that is life-giving and life-saving. This was the scandal. This was the foolishness. This was the difficulty that Paul was having in helping that congregation make a transition from what it meant to what it means. That the cross could somehow be a sign of faith, even more perhaps a symbol of our salvation. How can this be? We see it everywhere, used and misused today, simplified and made so that it loses meaning. So let's attempt to recapture what it is that Paul and the argument that Paul makes in 1 Corinthians, beginning with addressing the clear scandal and foolishness that the church in Corinth is struggling with. What does the cross really mean? The culmination of Paul's gradual argument that he's making in this first letter to the church in Corinth really culminates in 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We referred to this a few weeks ago. It's often called the love chapter. And what happens in this chapter is fascinating because Paul moves his argument from addressing the scandal and the foolishness, gradually building a case for finally culminating in this 13th chapter where the cross now is represented most fully by this bizarre word that Paul chooses to represent what it is God has done in Jesus on the cross. The word that Paul chooses is a very strange, also troubling choice. So the very people that are wrestling with the cross and what it meant in their minds, a scandal, an instrument of torture, now this word that Paul chooses to represent God's love in Jesus on the cross is a word that people were baffled by. First of all, we call this the love chapter because the word in English, love, is used throughout. What Paul used, and what was in a way scandalous also then, is a word that scholars say now is kind of a what had been a weak Greek word. You know, many of you, that the Greeks had a number of words for love. Just like Eskimos have lots and lots of words for snow, the Greeks had a lot of different words for love. We know of at least 8, there probably were as many as 11 or 12, but we know 4 of them easily can come to mind. One, of course, is we have a city named after it, Philadelphia, Philia. The love that is deep and broad, it is about friendship and the depth of compassion that we can have for those we really care about. Brotherly and sisterly love. We also know about eros. We get the word erotic, and it doesn't have to be a negative connotation at all. Eros is simply a self-love, a caring for one's self, eros. There also was another word, storge. Storge was a love that a parent could have for a child, a parent should have for a child. And all of these words in some ways could have been used in this 13th chapter, but instead Paul chooses specifically a word that had not been used that much. It was considered again by the scholarly community to be a word that just really was sort of a weak word for love. And that's because originally this word represented the love that a slave or a servant would have for a master. It is a self-giving, self-effacing, humble love that is willing to take no credit for the jobs that are done. Everything is simply done on behalf of another. The word, of course, in Greek that we use now in English interchangeably is agape. It's a word that we, of course, take for granted now and know its meaning. We think, well, but in fact, it too was a scandalous use of this weak word for love. Why would we represent God's love with a servant's love for a master? This makes no logical sense. But in Paul's mind, in the biblical understanding of what the cross really means, this is the perfect word to represent God's love. Why? Because through Jesus, giving himself fully to us as a servant, as Paul says in the second chapter of Philippians, even death on the cross, giving himself fully, emptying himself completely, allowing himself to be given to us. This is the amazing thing that agape represents, this self-giving, compassionate love on behalf of another. The cross, then, this scandal, this foolishness, the cross instead now represented by this love of God that is giving to another without a sense of selfishness or self-giving. It is this love, this scandal, this foolishness. It is a course-shifting, history-changing, life-rearranging, mind-bending, universal upending of everything that was and is yet to come. It is God's way of shifting the world in a way that later Christians would pick up on. When folks in the Roman Empire would begin to see the Christian church and the way it was operating, they would begin to say things like, "You Christians, you are turning things upside down," to which the Christians would say, "No, we are turning things right side up." In other words, what the cross does is take our temporal selves and our foolishness and our selfishness and connect us with the eternal, to allow us through God's love and the power of God's agape to be changed ourselves, so that with this vertical connection from our temporal to God's eternal, we then have the horizontal bridge that allows us within our individual lives to become communal people and have this connectedness to one another, not because of our own strength or our own personal courage or our own abilities, but rather God's agape self-giving love channeled through us, to us, and with us, so that those around us also feel a sense of God's presence and God's love through us to them, and through them to others. The cross, then, this remarkable shape, helps us understand the transformative nature of what God does in Jesus through the power of the cross. What the cross really means, then, is God's agape, self-giving, loving us so much that we have Jesus giving himself on the cross. Brothers and sisters, what the cross really means today, we must reclaim this power. It's not about keeping power or taking power. It certainly is not about holding one racial group over another. It's not about being better than, but being with. It's a matter of not taking power or keeping power, but allowing God's power to be channeled through us in God's radical agape self-giving love through Jesus. Brothers and sisters, this is what the cross really means. And it's why on this little cross that I have in my office, these words can be embedded so beautifully on it from Isaiah chapter 40. "Those who trust in the Lord shall renew their strength. They will soar with wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not faint." Not because of my power or your courage or our ability, but because of God's agape love channeled through us, so that God's power lives and makes alive our weakness, so that we then can become strong in God's love. This is what the cross really means. Thanks be to God. Amen.